truth, do you? You're the one who doesn't want to listen. Charlotte picked up her handbag and let herself out the back door without another word. She didn't slam the door, but there was something in the way she shut it that spoke of finality. In the wake of her departure, none of us could think of a thing to say. William broke the silence. I hope I didn't cause a problem. I nearly laughed because it was so obvious he had. Henry said, I hate to think what might have happened if you hadn't brought it up. I'll talk to Gus myself and see if I can persuade him that he and his house aren't in jeopardy. William stood and reached for his own overcoat. I should go. Rosie will be setting up for lunch. He started to say something more, but must have thought better of it. Once he was gone, the silence lingered. Henry's chopping had slowed. He was preoccupied, probably replaying the argument in his head. He'd remember the points he scored and forget hers. You want to talk about it? I asked. I think not. You want company? Not at the moment. I don't mean to be rude about it, but I'm upset. If you change your mind, you know where I am. I went back to my place and got out my cleaning supplies. Scrubbing bathrooms has always been my remedy for stress. Drink and drugs before noon on Saturday was too sordid to contemplate. In the unlikely event that I hadn't been exposed to enough conflict for one day, I decided to pay a visit to the Guffeys out in Colgate. Richard Compton had left a message the day before on my office machine, indicating that the Guffeys still hadn't paid their rent. He'd gone into court Friday morning and filed a complaint of unlawful detainer, which he wanted me to serve. You can add it to your invoice. I've got the paperwork right here. I might have argued the point, but he'd given me a lot of work of late, and Saturday is a good day for catching people at home. I'll swing by your house on the way out there, I said. Chapter 19. I fired up my trusty Mustang and made the detour to Compton's house on the Upper East Side. Then I headed north on the 101. Deadbeats tend to be centrally located. Certain neighborhoods and certain enclaves, being run down and cheap, apparently attract like-minded individuals. Perhaps some people, even those in the crudest circumstances, were still living beyond their means, and therefore got sued, served, and summoned to court by those to whom they were indebted. I could imagine a population of the fiscally irresponsible exchanging tricks of the trade, promises, partial payments, talk of checks in the mail, bank errors, and lost envelopes. These were the people who imagined they were somehow exempt from accountability. Most matters that passed through my hands spoke of those who felt entitled to swindle and deceive. They cheated their employers, stiffed their landlords, blew off their bills. Why not? Going after them took time and money, and netted their creditors little. People without assets are bulletproof. You can threaten all you like, but there's nothing to collect. I circled the four-building complex, checking the space in the carport assigned to apartment 8. Empty. Either they'd sold their vehicle, assuming they had one to begin with, or they were out on a happy Saturday jaunt. I continued around the block and pulled up across the street from their apartment. I took a paperback mystery novel from my shoulder bag and found my place. I read in the peace and quiet of my car, glancing up at intervals to see if the Guffeys had come home. At 3:20, sure enough, I heard a car rattling and coughing like an old crop duster on approach. I looked up in time to see a banged-up Chevrolet sedan turn down the alleyway and into the Guffeys' carport. The vehicle resembled many I've seen advertised by vintage car nuts, who buy and sell classic cars composed entirely of rust and dings. Dismantled, the parts were worth more than the whole. Jackie Guffey and a man I pegged as her husband came around the corner of the building with their arms loaded with bulging plastic bags from a nearby discount store. Their failure to pay their rent must have given them lots of extra cash to spend. I waited until they disappeared into the apartment, and then I got out of my car. I crossed the street, climbed the stairs, and knocked on their door. Alas, no one deigned to respond. Jackie, are you in there? After a moment, I heard a muffled, "No." I squinted at the door. "Is that Patty?" Silence. I said, "Is Grant home?" Silence. "Anyone?" I took out a roll of duct tape and affixed the notice of unlawful detainer to the front door. I knocked on the door again and said, "Mail's here." On my way home, I slid by the row of boxes outside the main post office and sent a second copy of the notice to the Guffeys by first-class mail. Monday morning, I woke early, feeling anxious and out of sorts. Henry's quarrel with Charlotte had unsettled me. I lay on my back, covers pulled up to my chin, and stared up at the clear plexiglass skylight above my bed. Still dark as pitch outside, but I could see a sprinkling of stars, so I knew the sky was clear. I have a low tolerance for conflict. As an only child, I got along with myself very well, thanks. I was happy being in my room alone, where I could color in my coloring book, using the crayons from my 64-shade box with a sharpener built right in. Many coloring books were dumb, but my aunt made a point of purchasing the better specimens. I could also play with my teddy bear, whose mouth would lever open if you pressed a button under its chin. I'd feed the bear hard candy and then turn him over and undo the zipper in his back. I'd remove the candy from the little metal box that passed for a tummy and eat it myself. The bear never complained. This is still my notion of a perfect relationship. School was a source of great suffering to me, but once I learned to read, I disappeared into books, where I was a happy visitor to all the worlds that sprang full-blown from the printed pages. My parents died when I was 5, and Aunt Jin, who took over the parenting, was as unsociable as I. She had a few friends, but I can't say she was intimate with anyone. As a result, I grew up ill-prepared for disagreements, differences of opinion, clashes of will, or the need for compromise. I can handle contention in my professional life, but if a personal relationship turns testy, I head for the door. It's simply easier that way. This explains why I've been married and divorced twice, and why I don't anticipate making the same mistake again. The spat between Henry and Charlotte was making my stomach hurt. At 5:36, having abandoned the notion of going back to sleep, I rolled out of bed and into my running clothes. The sun wouldn't rise for an hour. The sky was that odd shade of silver that precedes the dawn. The bike path glowed under my feet as though lit from below. At State, I veered left, following my new jogging route. I was wearing my headset, listening to the local light rock station. The street lamps were still on, throwing out circles of white, like a series of large polka dots through which I ran. Seasonal decorations were long gone, and the last of the browning Christmas trees had been dragged to the curb and left for pickup. On the return, I paused to check the progress on the pool rehabilitation at the Paramount Hotel. Gunite was being sprayed over the rebar, which I took as an encouraging sign. I jogged on. Running is a form of meditation, so naturally my thoughts turned to eating, a wholly spiritual experience in my book. I contemplated the notion of an Egg McMuffin, but only because McDonald's doesn't serve QPs with cheese at so early an hour. I walked the last few blocks home, taking the time to review events. I hadn't yet had the opportunity to talk to Henry about his falling out with Charlotte, which ran in an endless loop in my head. On reflection, what snagged my attention was the little side trip their argument had taken. Charlotte was convinced Solana Rojas had played a part in the rift between them. That bothered me. Without Solana's help, there was no way Gus could manage living on his own. He was dependent on her. We were all of us dependent on her because she'd stepped into the breach, shouldering the burden of his care. That put her in a position of power, which was cause for concern. How easy it would be for her to take advantage of him. I'd turned up no hint of trouble in the course of the background check, but even if Solana's record was spotless, people can and do change. She was in her early 60s, and maybe she hadn't set anything aside for her retirement years. Gus might not be worth a lot, but he might have more than she did. Financial inequity is a powerful goad. Dishonest folks like nothing better than to shift assets out of the pockets of those who have them and into their own. I turned the corner from Bay onto Albanil, pausing as I passed Gus's place. Lights were on in the living room, but there was no sign of Solana and no sign of him. I glanced at the dumpster as I passed. The grungy wall-to-wall carpeting had been ripped up and lay over the discards like a blanket of brown snow. I surveyed the remaining rubbish, as I did most days. It looked like Solana had tipped the contents of a wastebasket into the dumpster. The avalanche of falling paper had separated, sliding into various crevices and crannies like snow settling on a mountaintop. I could see junk mail, newspapers, flyers, and magazines. I tilted my head. There was an envelope with red line around the rim, caught in a fold of the wall-to-wall carpeting. I reached down and retrieved it, taking a closer look. The envelope was addressed to Augustus Vronsky and bore the return address of Pacific Gas and Electric. The flap was still sealed. This was one of Gus's utility bills. The red rim suggested a certain stern reprimand, and I was guessing his payment was overdue. What was this doing in the trash? I'd seen the pigeonholes in Gus's roll-top desk. His paid and unpaid bills had been neatly segregated, along with receipts, bank statements, and other financial documents. I remembered being impressed that he kept his affairs in such good working order. Despite his deplorable housekeeping skills, it was clear he was conscientious about day-to-day business matters. I turned the envelope over in my hand. Had he not been paying his bills? That was worrisome. Idly, I picked at the edge of the flap, debating the wisdom of taking a peek. I know the federal regulations related to postal theft. It's against the law to steal someone else's mail, no ifs, ands, or buts. What's also true is that a document placed in a trash container sitting at the curb no longer retains its character as the personal property of the one who tossed it. In this case, it looked like the unopened bill had ended up in the trash by mistake, which meant it was still hands-off. What was I supposed to do? If this was a dunning notice, and I left it where I'd found it, his utilities might be cut. On the other hand, if I kept the envelope, I might end up in the federal pen. What bothered me was the virtual certainty that Gus wasn't the one who emptied the trash these days. Solana did that. I hadn't seen Gus outside for the past 2 months. He was barely ambulatory, and I knew he wasn't taking care of routine chores. I climbed his porch stairs and put the bill in the mailbox affixed to his front door frame, and then went back to my place. I'd have given anything to find out if Gus was looking after his finances properly. I passed through the gate and rounded the studio to the rear. I let myself in and went up the spiral stairs to the loft, where I stripped off my running sweats and hopped in the shower. Once I was dressed, I ate my cereal, after which I crossed the patio and knocked on Henry's back door. He was sitting at the kitchen table with a cup of coffee, the paper spread out in front of him. He got up to open the door. I held on to the frame, leaning forward to have a quick look around. No fights in progress? Nope. The coast is clear. You want coffee? I do. He let me in, and I sat down at the kitchen table while he got out a mug and filled it, then set the milk and sugar in front of me, saying, "That's regular milk, not the usual half and half." To what do I owe the pleasure? I hope you're not going to lecture me on my bad behavior. I'm thinking about taking Gus some homemade soup. You need a recipe? Not quite. I was actually hoping to score soup that was already made. You have any in your freezer? Why don't we have a look? If I'd thought of it, I'd have taken him a batch myself. He opened his freezer and began to pull out a series of Tupperware containers, each neatly labeled with the contents and the date. He studied one. Mulligatawny soup. I'd forgotten I had that. Doesn't sound like something you'd make. You're more the chicken noodle type. Exactly, I said, watching as he retrieved a quart container from the very back of the shelf. The label was so frost-covered he had to scrape it with his thumbnail. July of 85? I think the Vichyssoise is past its sell-by date. He placed the jar in the sink to thaw and returned to his search. I saw you jogging this morning. What were you doing out so early? You'll be proud of me. I walked 2 miles by my count. I enjoyed myself. Charlotte's a good influence. Was. Oh, I don't suppose you want to talk about it. Nope. He pulled out another container and read the top. How about chicken with rice? It's only 2 months old. Perfect. I'll thaw it first and take it over hot. It's more convincing that way. He closed the freezer and set the rock-hard soup container on the table near me. What's brought about such a neighborly gesture? I've been worried about Gus, and this is my excuse for a visit. Why do you need an excuse? Maybe not an excuse so much as a purpose. Not to get into the issue one way or the other, but Charlotte seemed to think Solana had a hand in putting the two of you at odds. I was wondering why she'd do that. I mean, if she's up to something, how would either of us know? I wouldn't set too much store by what Charlotte says. Although, to be fair about it, I don't think what she did was necessarily wrong, just opportunistic. Is there any chance you'll patch things up? I doubt it. She's not going to apologize to me, and I certainly won't apologize to her. You sound just like me. Surely not that stubborn, he remarked. At any rate, on the subject of Solana, I thought you did a background check and she was clean. Maybe so, maybe not. Melanie asked me to take a quick look, and that's what I did. I know she doesn't have a criminal record because I researched that first. So you're going over there to snoop? More or less. If it comes to nothing, it's fine and dandy with me. I'd rather make a fool of myself than have Gus at risk. When I got back to my place, I put the container of frozen soup in the kitchen sink and ran warm water around it to thaw. I found a bowl and set it on the counter, then took out a saucepan. I was already thinking of myself as a domestic little bun. While I waited for the soup to heat, I started a load of laundry. As soon as the soup was ready, I put it back in the Tupperware container and trotted it over to Gus's next door. I knocked, and Solana appeared from the hallway a moment later. A quick glance showed that the red-rimmed envelope was still in the box, and I left it where it was. Ordinarily, I'd have plucked it out and handed it over with a quick explanation, but given her paranoia, if I made reference to it, she'd think I was spying on her, which of course I was. When she opened the door, I held up the container. I made a big pot of soup and thought Gus might enjoy some. Solana's demeanor was less than welcoming. She took the container, murmured a thank you, and was on the verge of closing the door when I spoke up in haste. How's he doing? I got the dark, flat stare, but she seemed to reconsider the urge to snub me. She dropped her gaze. He's napping right now. He had a rough night. His shoulder's bothering him. I'm sorry to hear that. Henry talked to him yesterday, and he was under the impression Gus was doing better. Visitors tire him. You might mention it to Mr. Pitts. He stayed longer than he should have. By the time I got here at 3, Mr. Vronsky'd taken to his bed. He dozed much of the day, which is why he slept so poorly last night. He's like a baby with his days and nights mixed up. I wonder if his doctor would have something to suggest. He has an appointment Friday. I intend to mention it, she said. Was there something else? Well, yes. I'm on my way to the market, and I wondered if you needed anything. I wouldn't want to trouble you. It's no trouble at all. I'm going anyway, and I'd be happy to help. I can even sit with Gus if you'd prefer to go yourself. Solana ignored that offer. If you'll wait here, I have a thing or two you could pick up. Sure. I'd invented the supermarket errand on the spot, desperate to prolong the contact. She was like the keeper at the gate. You couldn't get to Gus unless you went through her. I watched her move into the kitchen, where she set the soup container on the counter and then vanished, probably finding pen and paper. I stepped into the living room and glanced at Gus's desk. The cubbyhole that had held his bills was empty, but the passbooks for his 2 savings accounts were still where I'd seen them before. It looked like his checkbook was wedged in there as well. I was panting to scrutinize his finances, at the very least making sure his bills were being paid. I shot a glance at the kitchen door. No sign of Solana. If I'd acted right then, I might have had my way. As it was, my hesitation cost me the opportunity. Solana appeared 2 beats later, her purse under her arm. The list she gave me was short, a few items scribbled on a piece of scratch paper. I watched her open her wallet and remove a $20 bill that she held out to me. "Place looks better with that old ratty carpet gone," I said, as though I'd spent the time she'd been gone admiring her latest handiwork instead of plotting to steal Gus's bank books. I was kicking myself. In seconds, I could have crossed the room and had the records in hand. "I do what I can. Ms. Oberlin tells me you and Mr. Pitts did a cleaning before she arrived." It didn't amount to much. A lick and a promise, as my aunt used to say. "Is this it?" I paused and glanced at the list. Carrots, onions, mushroom broth, turnips, a rutabaga, and new potatoes. Nutritious, wholesome. "I promised Mr. Vronsky some fresh vegetable soup. His appetite's been off, and it's the only thing he'll eat. Meat of any kind makes him nauseous." I could feel my cheeks tint. I guess I should have asked first. "The soup's chicken with rice. Maybe when he's feeling better." She moved closer, essentially walking me toward the door. She might as well have put a hand on my arm and marched me out. I took my time at the grocery store, pretending I was shopping for myself as well as Gus. I didn't know what a rutabaga looked like, so after a frustrating search, I had to consult with a clerk in produce. He handed me a big, gnarly vegetable like a bloated potato with a waxy skin and a few green leaves growing out one end. "Are you serious?" He smiled. "You've heard of neeps and tatties? That's a neep, also called a Swede. The Germans survived on those in the winter of 1916-1917. Who'd have thunk? I returned to my car and headed for home. As I rounded the corner from Bay onto Albanil, I saw the waste management company had picked up the dumpster and was hauling it away. I parked in the empty stretch of curb and went up Gus's porch steps with Solana's groceries. To thwart me, she accepted the plastic sack and change from the 20, then thanked me without inviting me inside. How exasperating. Now I'd have to come up with a fresh excuse to get in. Chapter 20. Wednesday, when I came home for lunch, I found Mrs. Dell standing on my porch in her full-length mink coat, holding the brown paper bag containing her Meals on Wheels delivery. "Hi, Mrs. Dell, how are you?"
"Not well. I'm worried."
"About what?"
"Mr. Vronsky's back door is locked, and there's a note taped to the glass saying he won't be needing our services.
Did he say anything to you?" "I haven't talked to him, but it does seem odd. The man has to eat.
If the food wasn't to his liking, I wish he'd mentioned it. We're happy to make adjustments if he has a problem."
"You didn't talk to him?"
"I tried. I knocked on the door as loudly as I could. I know he has trouble hearing, and I didn't want to leave if he was already hobbling down the hall. Instead, that nurse of his appeared. I could tell she didn't want to talk, but she finally opened the door. She told me he's refusing to eat, and she doesn't want the food to go to waste. Her attitude was very close to rude."
"She canceled Meals on Wheels?"
"She said Mr. Vronsky was losing weight. She took him to the doctor to have his shoulder checked, and sure enough, he's down 6 pounds. The doctor was alarmed. She acted like it was my fault."
"Let me see what I can do."
"Please. This has never happened to me. I feel terrible thinking it was something I did."
As soon as she'd left, I put a call through to Melanie in New York. As usual, I didn't speak to a live human being. I left a message, and she returned the call at 3 o'clock California time when she got home from work. I was in the office by then, but I set aside the report I was typing and told her about my conversation with Mrs. Dell. I thought she'd be startled about Meals on Wheels. Instead, she was irritated.
"And that's why you called? I know all this stuff. Uncle Gus has been griping about the food for weeks. At first, Solana didn't pay much attention because she thought he was just being ornery. You know how much he loves to complain."
Having observed the trait myself, I couldn't argue the point.
"What's he going to do about meals?"
"She says she can handle them. She offered to cook for him when she first came to work, but I thought it was too much to ask when she was already taking on his medical care.
Now, I don't know. I'm leaning in that direction, at least until his appetite returns. Really, I can't see a downside, can you? Melanie, don't you see what's going on here? She's building a wall around the guy, cutting off access. Oh, I don't think so, she said, her tone skeptical. Well, I do. All he does is sleep, and that can't be good for him. Henry and I go over there, but he's quote-unquote indisposed, or he doesn't feel like company. There's always some excuse. When Henry did manage a visit, she claimed Gus was so debilitated afterward he had to take to his bed. Sounds about right. When I'm sick, all I want to do is sleep. The last thing I need is someone sitting there making chit-chat. Talk about exhausting. Have you spoken to him recently? It's been a couple of weeks, which I'm sure suits her fine. She's made it clear she doesn't want me over there. I have to rack my brain to get a foot in the door. She's protective of him. What's so bad about that? Nothing if he were doing better. The man is going downhill. I don't know what to say. Solana and I talk every couple of days, and I'm not getting this from her. Of course not. She's the one doing it. Something's wrong. I can feel it in my bones. I hope you're not saying I should make another trip. I was out there 6 weeks ago. I know it's a hassle, but he needs the help. And I'll tell you something else. If Solana knows you're coming, she'll cover her tracks. Come on, Kinsey. She's asked me 3 or 4 times if I'd come out to see him, but I can't get away. Why make an offer like that if she were doing something wrong? Because she's devious. Melanie was quiet, and I imagined the little wheels going round and round. I thought maybe I was getting through to her, but then she said, Are you sure you're okay? Because this is all sounding very weird if you want to know the truth. I'm fine. Gus is the one I'm worried about. I don't doubt your concern, but all this cloak and dagger stuff is a bit melodramatic, don't you think? No. She made one of those long, low, exasperated sounds in her throat, like this was all too much. Okay, fine. Let's assume you're correct. Give me one concrete example. Now, I was the one silent for a beat. As usual, when confronted with a demand of that sort, my mind went blank. I can't think of one offhand. If you want my best guess, I'd say she's drugging him. Oh, for heaven's sake! If you think she's so dangerous, then fire her! I don't have the authority, that's up to you. Well, I can't do anything until I talk to her. Let's be fair about it. There are two sides to every story. If I fired her strictly on the basis of what you've said, she'd file a complaint with the Labor Relations Board about unfair treatment or dismissal without cause. You know what I'm saying. Shit, Melanie. If you talk to Solana about this, she'll go ballistic. That was her response the last time around when she thought I was checking up on her. How else am I supposed to find out what's going on? She's not going to admit to anything. She's too smart. But so far, it's just your word against hers. I don't mean to be hard-nosed, but I'm not flying 3,000 miles based on a feeling in your bones. Don't take my word for it. You think I'm so nuts? Why don't you call Henry and ask him? I didn't say you were nuts. I know you better than that. I'll think about it. We're swamped right now at work, and taking the time off would be a pain in the butt. I'll talk to my boss and get back to you. Typical of Melanie, that was the last conversation we had for a month. At 6 o'clock, I walked up to Rosie's and found Henry sitting at his usual table in the bar. I'd decided my sterling behavior entitled me to a meal out. The place was jumping. This was Wednesday night, which is known as hump day to working stiffs, the week being more than half done. Henry got up graciously and held my chair while I slid in next to him. He bought me a glass of wine, which I sipped while he finished his blackjack over ice. We ordered, or rather we listened, while Rosie debated what we'd have. She decided Henry would enjoy her a sportkult, a venison goulash. I told her about my nutritional goals, begging and pleading to be spared the sour cream and its many variations. She took this in stride, saying, "It's very good. No worry, for you I prepare guisada de guilota." "Wonderful. What's that?" "It's quail braised in tomatillo chili sauce." Henry shifted in his seat with a look of injury.
Why can't I have that? Okay, you both. I bring right away. When the food arrived, she made sure each of us had a glass of really bad red wine, which she poured with a flourish. I toasted her and sipped, saying, "Oh, yum," while my tongue shriveled in my mouth. Once she departed, I took a taste of sauce before I committed myself fully to the quail. "We have a problem," I said, picking at the bird with my fork. "I need to borrow the key to Gus's place." He looked at me for a moment. I don't know what he saw in my face, but he reached in his pocket and took out a ring of keys. He worked his way through the circle, and when he came to the key to Gus's back door, he forced it off the ring and put it in my outstretched palm. "I don't suppose you'd care to explain. Better for you if I keep my mouth shut. You won't do anything illegal." I put my fingers in my ears and did the la-la-la business. "I'm not hearing that. Did you ask something else? You never told me what went on when you took him the soup." I took my fingers out of my ears. That went fine, except she told me that his appetite was off, and any kind of meat made him sick. There I stood, having just given her the container full of chicken soup. I felt like an idiot. "But you talked to him?" "Of course not. Nobody does. When was the last time you talked to him?" "Day before yesterday." "Oh, that's right. And guess what? She says Gus took to his bed because you stayed too long and he was exhausted, which is bullshit. Plus, she canceled Meals on Wheels. I called Melanie to tell her, and that conversation went straight into the toilet. She implied I was making things up. Either which way, she feels Solana should have the chance to defend herself. She did suggest that it would be helpful if I had a shred of proof to support my suspicions. Thus, I held up the key. "Be careful." "No sweat," I said. Now all I needed was the opportunity. I believe, as many people do, that things happen for a reason. I'm not convinced there's a grand plan in place, but I do know that impulse and chance play a role in the universe, as does coincidence. There are no accidents. For instance, you're on a highway and your tire goes flat, so you pull over to the side of the road in hopes of flagging down help. Many cars go by, and when someone finally comes to your aid, he turns out to be the kid you sat behind in fifth grade. Or maybe you leave for work 10 minutes late, and because of that, you're caught in traffic. While ahead of you, the bridge you cross daily collapses, taking 6 cars with it. You might just as easily have left 4 minutes early, and down you'd have gone. Life is made up of these occurrences, for good or for ill. Some call it synchronicity. I call it dumb luck. Thursday, I left the office early for no particular reason. I'd grappled with a lot of paperwork that day, and maybe I was bored. As I rounded the corner from Cabana onto Bay, I passed Solana Rojas in her rattletrap convertible. Gus was hunched in the front seat, bundled into an overcoat. As far as I knew, he hadn't been out of the house in weeks. Solana was speaking to him intently, and neither looked up as I went by. In the rearview mirror, I saw her stop at the corner and make a right-hand turn. I figured she was taking him to another doctor's appointment, which later turned out not to be the case. I whipped into a parking place and locked my car, then trotted up the steps to Gus's front door. I made a show of knocking on the pane of glass in the door. I waved merrily at an imaginary someone inside, and then pointed toward the side and nodded, showing I understood. I went around the side of the house to the rear and climbed the back porch steps. I peered through the window pane in the door. The kitchen was empty and the lights were out. No big surprise. I used the key Henry'd given me to let myself in. The action was not strictly legal, but I put it in the same category as returning Gus's mail. I told myself I was doing a good deed. The problem was this. In the absence of an invitation, I had no legitimate reason to enter Gus Vronsky's house when he was home, let alone when he was out. It was pure chance that I'd seen him pass in Solana's car, heading off to God knows where. If I were caught, what possible explanation could I give for being in his house? There'd been no smoke boiling out his windows and no cries for help. No power failure, no earthquake, no gas leak, no break in the water main. In short, I had no excuse beyond my fear for his safety and well-being. I could just imagine how far that would fly in a court of law. In the course of this home invasion, I was hoping for one of two things: either reassurance that Gus was in good hands, or evidence I could act on if my suspicions were justified. I went down the hall into Gus's bedroom. The bed was neatly made, a place for everything and everything in place, being Solana Rojas's credo. I opened and closed a few drawers, but saw nothing out of the ordinary. I'm not sure what I expected, but that's why you look, because you don't know what's there. I went into his bathroom. His oblong pill organizer was sitting on the sink. The compartments for S, M, and T were empty, as was W. T, F, and S were still filled with assorted pills. I opened the medicine cabinet and scanned his prescription medications. I rooted through my shoulder bag until I found my notebook and pen. I wrote down the information from every bottle I saw: date, physician's name, the drug, the dosage, and instructions. There were 6 prescriptions altogether. I'm not well versed in pharmaceutical matters, so I made careful notes and replaced the containers on the shelf. I left the bathroom and continued down the hall. I opened the door to the second bedroom, where Solana kept clothing and personal items for use on the night she stayed over. This room was the former warehouse for numerous unlabeled cardboard boxes, all of which had been removed. The few pieces of antique furniture had been dusted, polished, and rearranged. I could see she'd made herself right at home. A handsome carved mahogany bed frame had been reassembled, and the linens were as taut as an army cot. There was a burled walnut rocking chair inlaid with cherry, an armoire, and a plump-shouldered fruitwood chest of drawers with ornate bronze drawer pulls. I opened 3 drawers in succession and saw that all were filled with Solana's clothes. I was tempted to search her room further, but my good angel suggested I was already risking jail and had better cease and desist. Between the second and third bedrooms, there was a full bath, but a quick peek through the open door revealed nothing significant. I did open the medicine cabinet and found it empty except for a number of cosmetics, which I'd never seen Solana wear. I crossed the hall and opened the door to the third bedroom. Someone had put heavy blackout drapes across the windows, so the room was dark and the air dense with heat. In the single bed against the wall, there was a massive shape. At first, I didn't understand what I was looking at. Oversized pillows? Laundry bags bulging with discarded clothes? I was so accustomed to Gus's hoarding that I assumed this was one more example of his inability to throw things out. I heard a grunt. There was a shifting motion, and the man lying in the bed turned from his left side to his right, so he was then facing the door. Though his upper body remained in shadow, a band of daylight bisected the bed, illuminating 2 glittering slits. Either he slept with his eyes open, or he was looking right at me. He didn't react, and there was no indication he'd registered my presence. Immobilized, I stood there and held my breath. In the depths of sleep, our animal instincts take over, alerting us to any dangers that arise. Even a subtle shift in temperature, a change in the air as it eddies through the room, the faintest of noises, or an alteration in the light can trigger our defenses. In changing positions, the man had moved up from the deepest recess of sleep. He was reaching for consciousness, ascending slowly like an underwater diver with a circle of open sky above his head. I would have mewed in fear, but I didn't dare make a sound. I backed out of the room, acutely aware of the whisper of my denim jeans as I moved, the press of my boot sole against the wood floor. I closed the door with infinite care, one hand firmly on the knob, the other resting against the edge of the door to prevent even the softest click as the door met the frame and the strike nosed into the plate. I turned and retraced my steps at the tiptoeing equivalent of a dead run.
I held my shoulder bag close to me, aware that the slightest bump of a kitchen chair might bring the fellow bolt upright, wondering who was in the house with him. I crossed the kitchen, let myself out the back door, and crossed the porch with the same caution. I descended the back porch steps, my ears cued to any sound behind me. The closer I got to safety, the more jeopardy I felt. I crossed Gus's grass. Between his property and Henry's, there was a short length of fencing and a longer stretch of hedge. When I reached the line of shrubs, I raised my arms to shoulder height and forced my way through a narrow gap between two bushes. Then, more or less, fell onto Henry's patio. I probably left a telltale path of broken twigs behind me, but I didn't stop to check. It wasn't until I was in my apartment with the door locked that I dared take a breath. Who the hell was that guy? I turned the thumb lock on the door, left the lights off, and went around the kitchen counter to a blind cul-de-sac where my sink, stove, and cupboards form a windowless U. I sank to the floor and sat there with my knees drawn up, waiting for someone to pound on the door and demand an explanation. Now that I was safe, my heart began to pound, banging in my chest like someone trying to break down a door with a battering ram. In my mind's eye, I ran through the entire sequence of events. The show I'd made of tapping on the window and the front door, pretending to communicate with someone inside. I'd tromped merrily down the front steps and tromped merrily up the back. Once inside, I'd opened and closed doors. I'd slid drawers back and forth on their tracks, checked two medicine cabinets, which by all rights should have squeaked on their hinges. I paid no attention to the noise I'd made because I thought I was alone. All the time, that gorilla was sleeping in the next room. Was I out of my freaking mind? After 30 seconds in hiding, I started to feel stupid. I hadn't been apprehended like some hot prowl burglar in the process of breaking and entering. No one had spotted me going in or out. No one had called the cops to report an intruder. Somehow, I'd escaped detection, as far as I knew. Nonetheless, the incident was meant as an object lesson for yours truly. I should have taken it to heart, but I was struck dumb by the realization that I'd passed up the chance to lift the passbooks to Gus's bank accounts. Chapter 21. On the way to work the next morning, I took Santa Teresa Street as far as Aurelia, and turned left and made a detour into a drugstore parking lot. Jones Apothecary was an old-fashioned pharmacy where the shelves were stocked with vitamins, first aid remedies, nutritional supplements, ostomy supplies, nostrums, skin, hair, and nail products, and other items meant to alleviate minor human miseries. You could have your prescriptions filled, but you couldn't buy lawn furniture. You could rent crutches and buy arch supports, but you couldn't have film developed. They did offer a free blood pressure check, and while I waited for service, I sat down and affixed the cuff to my arm. After much huffing, squeezing, and releasing, the readout was 118 over 68, so I knew I wasn't dead. As soon as the consultation window was free, I stepped up to the counter and caught the eye of the pharmacist, Joe Brooks, who'd been helpful in the past. He was a man in his 70s with snowy white hair that eddied into a swirl in the middle of his forehead. He said, "Yes, ma'am, how are you? I haven't seen you in a while." "I've been around, staying out of trouble as much as possible," I said. "Right now, I need some information. I thought you might help. I have a friend who's taking a number of medications, and I'm worried about him. I think he's sleeping too much, and when he's awake, he's confused. I'm wondering about side effects of the drugs he's on. I made a list of what he's taking, but the prescriptions weren't filled here." "That wouldn't make a difference. Most pharmacists handle patient consultations the same way we do. We make sure the patient understands what the medication does, the dosage, and how and when it should be taken. We also explain any possible food or drug interactions and advise them to call the doctor if they have reactions out of the ordinary." "That's what I assumed, but I wanted to double check. If I show you the list, can you tell me what these are for?"
"Shouldn't be a problem. Who's the doctor?"
"Medford. Do you know him?"
"I do, and he's a good egg."
I took out my notebook and folded it open to the relevant page.
He removed a pair of reading glasses from his jacket pocket and eased the stems over his ears. I watched him trace the lines of print with his eyes, commenting as he worked his way down the line. These are standard medications. The indapamide is a diuretic prescribed to lower blood pressure. Metoprolol's a beta blocker, again prescribed to treat hypertension. Chlorvess is a cherry-flavored potassium replacement that requires a prescription because potassium supplementation can affect heart rhythm and damage the GI tract. Butazolidin is an anti-inflammatory, probably for treatment of osteoarthritis. Did he ever mention that? I know he complains about his aches and pains. Osteoporosis, for sure. He's just about bent double from bone loss. I was looking over his shoulder, reading the list. What's that one? Clofibrate is used to reduce cholesterol, and this last one, Tagamet, is for acid reflux. The only thing I see worth scrutiny are his potassium levels. Low blood potassium could cause him to be confused, weak, or sleepy. How old is he? 89. He nodded, tilting his head as he considered the implications. Age plays a part, no doubt about that. Geriatric individuals don't excrete drugs as promptly as healthy younger people. Liver and kidney functions are also substantially reduced. Coronary output starts declining after age 30, and by 90 it's down to 30 to 40% of maximum. What you're describing might be an unrelated medical condition nobody's picked up on. He'd probably benefit from an evaluation by a geriatric specialist if he hasn't seen one. He's under doctor's care. He dislocated his shoulder in a fall a month ago and just went in for a recheck. I expected a quicker recovery rate, but he doesn't seem much improved. That may well be. Striated muscle also declines with age, so it's quite possible his shoulder repair has been impeded by torn musculature, the osteoporosis, undiagnosed diabetes, or an impaired immune system. Have you talked to his doctor? No, and I doubt it would be productive, given current privacy laws. His office wouldn't acknowledge his being a patient, let alone put his doctor on the phone to chat with some stranger about his care. I'm not even a family member. He's just a neighbor of mine. I'm assuming his caregivers conveyed all the information to his doctor, but I have no way of knowing. Joe Brooks thought about that, weighing the possibilities. If he was given pain pills for the shoulder, he might be abusing his meds. I don't see reference to anything of the sort, but he might have a supply on hand. Alcohol consumption's another consideration. I hadn't thought of that. I suppose either one is possible. I've never seen him take a drink, but what do I know? Tell you what, I'd be happy to call his doctor and pass along your concerns. I know this guy socially, and I think he'd listen to me. Let's hold off on that. His caregiver lives on the premises, and she's already hypersensitive. I don't want to step on her toes unless it's absolutely necessary. Understood, he said. I left the office at noon that day, thinking to make myself a quick lunch at home. When I rounded the studio and reached the back patio, I saw Solana knocking frantically on Henry's kitchen door. She'd thrown a coat over her shoulders like a shawl, and she was clearly upset. I paused on my doorstep. Is something wrong? Do you know when Mr. Pitts is getting home? I've knocked and knocked, but he must be out. I don't know where he is. Can I help you? I could see the conflict in her face. I was probably the last person on earth she'd be appealing to. But her problem must have been pressing because she clutched the edges of her coat with one hand and crossed the patio. I need a hand with Mr. Vronsky. I put him in the shower and I can't get him out. Yesterday he fell and hurt himself again, so he's afraid of slipping on the tile. Can we manage him between us? I hope so. Please. We walked double time to Gus's front door, which she'd left ajar. I followed her into the house, dropping my bag on the couch in the living room as we passed. She was talking over her shoulder, saying, I didn't know what else to do. I was getting him cleaned up before supper. He's had trouble with his balance, but I thought I could handle him. He's in here. She led me through Gus's bedroom into the bathroom, which smelled of soap and steam. The bathroom floor had a slippery cast to it, and I could see how difficult it would be to maneuver. Gus was huddled on a plastic stool in one corner of the shower. The water had been turned off, and it looked like Solana had done what she could to dry him off before she left. He was shivering despite the robe she'd thrown around him to keep him warm. His hair was wet, and water was still dripping down his cheek. I'd never seen him without clothes, and I was shocked at how thin he was. His shoulder sockets looked enormous, while his arms were all bone. His left hip was badly bruised, and he was weeping, making a whimpering sound that spoke of his helplessness. Solana bent over him. "You're fine. You're okay now. I found someone to help. Don't you worry." She dried him off, and then she took his right arm while I took his left, offering support as we hoisted him to his feet. He was shaky and clearly off-kilter, only able to take baby steps. She moved to a position in front of him and held him by the hands, walking backward to stabilize him as he tottered after her. I kept one hand under his elbow as he shuffled into the bedroom. As frail as he was, it was a trick to keep him upright and on the move. When we reached the bed, Solana stood him close by, leaning him against the mattress for support. He clung to me with both hands, while she slipped first one arm and then the other into his flannel pajama top. Below, the skin sagged from his thighs, and his pelvic bones looked sharp. We sat him on the edge of the bed, and she slipped his feet through his pajama bottoms. Together, we lifted him briefly so she could pull the bottoms up over his flanks. Again, she eased him onto the edge of the bed. When she lifted his feet and rotated his legs to slide them under the covers, he cried out in pain. She had a stack of old quilts nearby, and she laid three over him to offset his chill. His trembling seemed uncontrollable, and I could hear his teeth chattering. "Why don't I make him a cup of tea?" She nodded, doing what she could to make him comfortable. I moved down the hallway to the kitchen. The tea kettle was on the stove. I ran the tap until the water was hot, filled the kettle, then set it on the burner. Hastily, I went through the well-stocked cupboards, looking for tea bags. New bottle of vodka? No. Cereal, pasta, rice? Nix. I discovered the box of Lipton's on my third pass. I found a cup and saucer and set them on the counter. I went to the door and peered around the corner. I could hear Solana in the bedroom murmuring to Gus. I didn't dare stop to think about the risk I was taking. I slipped across the hall to the living room and moved to the desk. The pigeonholes were much as they'd been before. No bills or receipts in evidence. But I could see his bank statements, his checkbook, and two savings account passbooks held together by a single rubber band. I slipped off the band and took a quick look at the balances in his passbooks. The account that had originally held $15,000 appeared to be untouched. The second passbook showed a number of withdrawals, so I shoved that in my bag. I opened his checkbook and removed the register, then put the checkbook cover and the one savings passbook back in the cubbyhole. I moved to the couch and shoved the items to the bottom of my shoulder bag. Four long strides later, I was back in the kitchen, pouring boiling water over a Lipton's tea bag. My heart was banging so hard that when I carried the china cup and saucer down the hall to Gus's bedroom, the two rattled together like castanets. Before I went into the bedroom, I had to pour the tea I'd slopped from the saucer back into the cup. I found Solana sitting on the edge of the bed, patting Gus's hand. I set the cup and saucer on the bed table. The two of us arranged pillows behind his back and secured him in an upright position. "We'll let this cool, and then you can have a nice sip of tea," she said to him. His eyes sought mine, and I could see what I swore was a mute appeal. I glanced at the clock. "Didn't you say he had a doctor's appointment later today?" "With his internist, yes. Mr. Vronsky's been so shaky on his feet that I'm concerned." "Is he strong enough to go?" "He'll be fine. Once he's warm again, I can get him dressed." "What time is his appointment?" "In an hour. The doctor's office is only 10 minutes from here." 1:30? 2. "I hope everything's okay. I can wait and help you get him in the car if you like." "No, no. I can manage now. I'm grateful for your help." "I'm glad I was there. For now, unless you need me for something else, I'll be on my way," I said. I was torn between wanting to hover and needing to escape. I could feel a trickle of flop sweat in the small of my back. I didn't wait for a word of thanks, which I knew would be in short supply in any event. I moved through the living room, grabbed my shoulder bag, and went out to my car. With a glance at my watch, I fired up the engine and pulled away from the curb. If I played my cards right, I could make copies of Gus's financial data and get the checkbook and savings account book back in the desk while Solana was taking him to his appointment. When I reached my office, I unlocked the door, slung my bag on the desk, and turned on the copy machine. During the laborious warm-up process, I shifted from foot to foot, groaning at the delay. As soon as the readout announced the machine was ready, I began to make copies of the pages in the check register, plus the deposits and withdrawals recorded in the passbook. I'd study the figures later. Meanwhile, if I timed it right, I could head back to my place and hover in the wings. Once I saw Solana drive off with Gus for his doctor's appointment, I could slip in the back door and return the items, leaving her none the wiser. A capital plan. While it depended on proper timing, I was in the perfect position to pull it off, assuming the goon wasn't there. My copy machine seemed agonizingly slow. The carriage line of white-hot light ticked back and forth across the plate. I'd lift the lid, open the book to the next two pages, lower the lid, and press the button. The copy paper slid out of the machine, still hot to the touch. When I was finished, I turned off the machine and reached for my bag. That's when my gaze strayed to my desk calendar. The notation for Friday, January 15th, read, Millard Fredrickson, 2 p.m. I went around the desk and looked at the entry right side up. Shit. It took me half a minute to find the Fredrickson's telephone number. In hopes of rescheduling, I snatched up the handset and punched in the numbers. The line was busy. I checked the clock. It was 1:15. Solan had told me the doctor's office was 10 minutes away, which meant she'd leave at 1:30 or so to give herself time to park and ferry Gus into the building. He'd proceed at a creeping pace, especially in light of his recent fall, which must have left him in pain. She'd probably drop him at the entrance, park, and go back, guiding him through the automated glass doors and up the elevator. If I went to the Fredricksons early, I could conduct a quick interview and beat it back to my place before she returned. Anything I missed, I could ask Millard later in a follow-up call. The Fredricksons didn't live that far from me, and he'd probably be delighted to have me in and out of his place in the paltry 15 minutes I had to spare. I picked up my clipboard with the notes I'd taken during my chat with his wife. My anxiety level was way up, but I had to focus on the task at hand. The drive from my office to the Fredricksons naturally entailed being caught by any number of red lights. At the intersections controlled by stop signs, I'd do a quick visual survey, making sure there were no cop cars in evidence, and then I'd roll on through without bothering to stop. I turned onto the Fredrickson's street, parked across from the house, and made my way to the front door. I nearly lost my footing on the algae-slick wooden wheelchair ramp, but I caught myself before I went down on my butt. I was pretty sure I'd wrenched my back in a way I'd have to pay for later. I rang the bell and waited, expecting Gladys to come to the door as she had on my earlier visit. Instead, Mr. Fredrickson opened the door in his wheelchair with a paper napkin tucked in his shirt collar. "Hello, Mr. Fredrickson. I thought I'd pop in a few minutes early, but if I interrupted your lunch, I can always come back in an hour or so. Is that better for you?" I was thinking, "Please, please, please." But I didn't actually clasp my hands in prayer. He glanced down at the napkin and removed it with a tug. "No, no, I just finished. We might as well get started as long as you're here." He rolled himself back, made a 2-point turn, and pushed himself as far as the coffee table. "Grab a chair. Gladys is off at rehab, so I've got a couple hours to spare." The notion of spending 2 hours with the man made the panic rise anew. "It won't take me that long. A few quick questions and I'll get out of your hair. Is this seat okay?" I was busy stacking magazines and mail that I moved to one side so I could sit on the couch where I'd sat before. I heard a muffled barking from a back room. But there was no sign of the bird, so maybe the dog had had a nice lunch as well. I took out my tape recorder, which I hoped still had juice. I'll be recording this interview the same way I did with your wife. I hope you're agreeable. I was already punching buttons, getting properly set.
Yes, fine, anything you want.
I recited my name, his, date, time, subject matter, and other particulars, talking so fast it sounded like the tape recorder was operating at twice its normal speed. He folded his hands in his lap.
I might as well start at the beginning. I know how you people are.
I flipped through the pages on my yellow legal pad. I have most of the information here, so all I need is to fill in a few blanks. I'll be out of here shortly.
Don't hurry on my account. We have nothing to hide. Her and me had a long talk about this, and we intend to cooperate. Seems only fair.
I dropped my gaze to the reel turning in the machine and felt my body grow still. We appreciate that, I said. The phrase, we have nothing to hide, echoed through my frame. What came immediately to mind was the old saying, the louder he proclaims his honesty, the faster we count the silver. His aside was the equivalent of someone beginning a sentence with the phrase, to be perfectly honest. You can just about bet whatever comes next will be straddling the line between falsehood and an outright lie. Anytime you're ready, I said, without looking at him. He related his rendition of the accident in tedious detail. His tone was rehearsed, and his account so clearly mimicked what I had heard from her that I knew they'd conferred at length. Weather conditions, seat belt, Lisa Ray's abruptly pulling into his lane, the slamming on of brakes, which he accomplished with his hand control. Gladys couldn't possibly remember everything she told me, but I knew if I spoke to her again, her story would be amended until it was a duplicate of her husband's. I scribbled as he spoke, making sure I was covering the same ground. There's nothing worse than running into an inaudible response when a tape is transcribed. At the back of my mind, I was fretting about Gus. I had no idea how I'd get the financial data back where it belonged, but I couldn't worry about that now. I nodded as Mr. Fredrickson went on and on. I made sympathetic noises and kept my expression a near parody of interest and concern. He warmed to the subject as he proceeded with his narrative. 32 minutes later, when he started repeating himself, I said, "Well, thanks. I think this about covers it. Is there anything else you'd like to add for the record?"
"I believe that's it," he said. "Just a mention of where we were going when that Lisa Ray woman ran into us. I believe you asked my wife and it slipped her mind."
"That's right," I said. He fidgeted slightly and his voice had changed, so I knew a whopper was about to escape his lips. I leaned forward attentively, pen poised over the page.
"The market."
"Ah, the market. Well, that makes sense. Which one?"
"That one on the corner at the bottom of the hill."
I nodded, taking notes. "And the trip was to buy what?"
"Lottery ticket for Saturday's draw. I'm sorry to say we didn't win."
"Too bad." I turned off the tape recorder and anchored my pen in the top of my clipboard. "This has been a big help. I'll stop by with the transcript as soon as I have it done." I drove back to my place without much hope. It was 2:45, and Solana and Gus would probably be back from the doctor's office. If Solana went into the living room and spotted the empty cubbyhole, she'd know what I'd done. I pulled up in front of my place, parked the car, and scanned the cars on both sides of the street. No sign of Solana's. I could feel my heart rate accelerate. Was it possible I still had time? All I needed was to nip inside, shove everything back in the desk, and make a hasty getaway. I put my car keys in my bag and crossed Gus's grass, following the walkway to the back door. The checkbook register and the savings passbook were in the bowels of my bag. I had my hand on the documents as I climbed the back steps. I could see the note for the Meals on Wheels volunteer still taped to the glass. I peered in the window. The kitchen was dark. 10 or 15 seconds was all I required, assuming the goon wasn't waiting for me in the living room. I took out the key, inserted it in the lock, and turned it. No deal. I held the knob and wiggled the key by way of coaxing. I looked down in puzzlement, thinking Henry'd given me the wrong key. Not so. The locks had been changed. I moaned to myself as I headed down the stairs double time, worried I'd be caught when I hadn't actually accomplished anything. I cut through the hedge between Gus's backyard and Henry's and let myself into the studio. I locked my door and sat down at my desk, panic rising in my throat like bile. If Solana realized the check register and passbook were missing, she'd know I'd taken them. Who else? I was the only one who'd been in the house except for the fellow in the bed. Henry'd been there a couple days before, so he'd come under suspicion as well. The dread in my gut felt like a bomb about to go off, but there was nothing to be done. I sat quietly for a moment until I'd caught my breath. What difference did it make now? What was done, and as long as I was screwed, I might as well see what my thievery had netted me. I spent the next 10 minutes looking at the figures in Gus's bank accounts. It didn't take an accountant to see what was going on. The account that had originally held $22,000 had been reduced by half. All of this in the space of a month. I flipped back through the earlier pages of the passbook. It looked like Gus, in his pre-Solana days, was making deposits of $2,000 to $3,000 at regular intervals. His check register showed that since January 4th, money had been transferred from the one savings account into his checking account with a number of checks then written to cash. None of the canceled checks were available for inspection, but I'd have bet money his signatures were forged. At the back of the passbook, I came across the pink slip to his car that must have migrated from its proper file. To date, she hadn't transferred ownership from his name to hers. I reviewed the numbers with a shake of my head. It was time to quit cocking around. I pulled out the phone book and turned to the listings for county offices. I found the number for the domestic elder abuse telephone hotline, which I couldn't help but notice spelled the word death. It had finally dawned on me that I didn't have to prove Solana was doing anything abusive or illegal. It was up to her to prove she wasn't. Chapter 22. The woman who answered the phone at the Tri-Counties Agency for the Prevention of Elder Abuse listened to my brief explanation of the reason for my call. I was transferred to a social worker named Nancy Sullivan, and I ended up having a 15-minute conversation with her while she took the report. She sounded young, and her phone manner suggested she was asking questions from a form she had in front of her. I gave her the relevant information: Gus's name, age, address, Solana Rojas's name and description.
Does he have any known medical problems?
Lots. This whole situation started with a fall that dislocated his shoulder. Aside from the injury, it's my understanding that he suffers from hypertension, osteoporosis, probably osteoarthritis, and maybe some digestive problems.
What about signs of dementia?
I'm not sure how to answer that. Solana Rojas reports signs of dementia, but I haven't seen any myself. His niece in New York talked to him on the phone one day and thought he sounded confused. The first time I went over, he was sleeping. But when I stopped by the next morning, he seemed fine. Crabby.